Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Inspire Health Podcast. And as we continue on with our series on the illusion of free choice, returning to mastering your life. And today we are bringing back Spencer Feldman. So I've had Spencer on the show a couple of times. And if you watched our last episode, I just had Spencer on for our detox series on episode 153. I'll put a link up on the show notes. Go and check that out. Spencer gives a lot of really amazing detailed information around things. And the first one, I'll put this other episode up there too, so you can take a look at it. We went through a lot of information around detox. In the last one, we kind of tied in the five elements of Chinese medicine, cleansing, and we talked specifically about the four detox traps. Spencer is the founder of Remedy Link, and he's been doing that for quite some time now, about 20 years or so, or probably longer than that now. It might even be have to update your bio on that. But they make a lot of really amazing formulations, and they manufacture detoxification products in a really unique way. And so I really appreciate the work that Spencer's doing and wanted to bring him back, because if you watched episode 153, we kind of left you on a little bit of a cliffhanger around the microbiome. So we started to get into that and decided to hold that conversation for today, because I think it fits in really well with this concept of the illusion of free choice and the return back to mastering our own life. Because we often talk about the biome, particularly the gut biome, as our second or our third brain. So maybe we can dive right into that and explore that concept and how that affects us on a whole number of levels. So Spencer, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jason.
Always a pleasure chatting with you, Spencer.
So yeah, let's talk about the microbiome. And the first thing I would say is a lot of people think the gut's the second brain. It's the first brain. It was here way before human, you know, before we had brains. So there has been microbiomes for as long as there have been creatures with guts, which takes you back to worms and parasites and wiggling things and primordial oceans. So the microbiome was the first brain. And then we outsourced this lump on top of our neck to organize the sensory data and muscle movement and cognition. But it's the first brain. And the... Well, you know, what the microbiome is, it's a superorganism. It's it's a mix of thousands of different bacteria and viruses and bacteriophages that live in and on us symbiotically. And the primary microbiome is the large intestine, which runs the whole show, but there's microbiomes in every organ. It's in the brain, it's in the lungs, it's everywhere. So it's responsible for homeostasis, meaning, you know, there's always going to be a natural ebb and flow and tide and flux and cyclical activity of all the systems of the body, and it's supposed to stay between two values, right? You don't want your blood sugar going so high or so low. You want it balancing. You don't want your dopamine jacked so high to mania or so low that it's depression. You want it steady as she goes. And the microbiome is what's responsible for maintaining the homeostasis for things like neurotransmitters and hormones. So there gives you your entire mood and your thought processes. And then other things in terms of health, like the immune system and antibodies, digestion and enzymes, blood sugar, insulin sensitivity, body fat, sleep cycles. And it does this by managing the levels of a staggering 500,000 different metabolites that make up 40% of the compounds in your blood. So it's no small player in the body. It's huge. And to compare it to the immune system, the microbiome has more immune cells in your blood and bone marrow. In terms of hormones, your microbiome has more endocrine cells than all of your endocrine glands of your body combined. And in terms of information processing, the microbiome is three times heavier than the brain. In terms of genetics, the microbiome is 1,000 times more genetic information that we have access to than our own DNA. So that gives us a sense of just how enormous it is. So why don't we know about this thing? All right, so here's a thought experiment. You know, tell someone to draw a tree. Well, okay, they draw the ground, and then they draw the trunk, and then they draw the branches, and then they draw the leaves, and, you know, maybe a little squirrel, or, you know, and maybe a little bird nest. And they say, okay, that where's the other half? And they're like, well, what do you mean the other half? I'm like, the half that's below ground, the roots, all the bacteria and fungi all on the roots that help the roots absorb all the nutrients. Where's that? Like, oh, right. And so they draw that in. And that's the other half of the tree, right? The other half is the roots. Well, the microbiome is the roots of our metabolic tree. And if the roots aren't healthy and in a tree or a human, then everything goes wrong. basically, the microbiome is the single most important and most overlooked part of staying healthy. So let's just kind of go historically about, you know, how do we get it? How did we lose it? You know, and what's our relationship with it? Because it's an ancient symbiont that we live with. And as with any ally, we should be symbiotic. We should be giving to it if we want it to give back to us, right? We don't want this to be a one-way selfish relationship. So how do we get it? Well, every animal with a gut has a microbiome. So, you know, based on archaeological studies, depending on if you believe archaeology, you know, we've been around in our relatively current form for about 800,000 years. And, you know, for most of that, you know, we've been eating tubers, which is sort of like a root vegetable, but more like the storage section of the root of the plant. Wild game, insects, fruit, seaweed, nuts, honey, if you wanted to brave getting bitten by bees, although a lot of bees actually don't bite. Maybe just smoke them out. Anyway, and in addition to all these fats and proteins and carbohydrates, these foods had things called oligosaccharides, which are these class of sugars that we can't digest, but bacteria can. So what happens is we're eating these things, and the part that we can't eat, the bacteria that's been living in our gut and our ancestors' guts for billions of years are eating the oligosaccharides. And, you know, while initially way back in time, the bacteria in the gut were parasitic and would kill the host, relatively quickly, the bacteria in the gut of any animal, including humans, learns to support the host, right? So things like Ebola kill the host. There, it's a relatively new infection. Things like herpes that has been around for a long time does not kill anybody. And as a matter of fact, most people have herpes and don't even know it. It's because the longer you coexist with another species, the more relaxed it gets and the more it learns to work with you. And because it wants you to stay alive so it can stay alive. So over time, it learned to, you know, be symbiotic with us. It learned how to make us physically stronger, mentally smarter, fight infections better, heal faster, age slower, on and on. In other words, the microbiome is the most powerful ally and valuable upgrade human beings will ever have. You know, people think AI and chips in the head, you know, from Elon Musk, and these are all upgrades. No, the upgrade is ancient, and we already have it. The question is, do you know how to access and coexist with it in a way that you can use it to your best advantage? So I want to talk about four initiations that the microbiome gives us. Rites of passage, really. Now, the first initiation happens when you're inside the mother's womb, and metabolites produced by the mother's microbiome pass through the placenta and guide and organize and manage the growth of the developing fetal brain, organizing the neural architecture. So in a very real sense, the microbiome is makes us humans, makes us the smart beings that we are inside the womb of the mother. All right, so that's how intimate the relationship is. It is what's guiding you into becoming you before you even had a body that necessarily looked human. Okay. Second initiation happens when the immunoglobulin A from breast milk, specifically colostrum, comes from the mother. Hopefully you get that. And educates organizes with the immune system. So the immune system recognizes the microbiome, which it just got through childbirth, as part of self. So, you know, you get this bacteria from the mother's vaginal canal, which is mostly lactobacillus, and then bifidus from a stool that's often present during childbirth, because, you know, the head comes down, it squeezes the stool out, and, you know, there's always going to be a little bit on the perineum. So a face-down delivery, you get a little bit. And then that seeds the gut. And as that happens, the colostrum then comes from the mother's milk and says, hey, all this bacteria you just got exposed to, don't freak out about it, right? This is actually good. It backfires if it happens when you get a hospital birth, like a premature delivery, and then you think that hospital-based infections shouldn't be attacked. But that's another world. Okay. And now the third initiation happens back with the brain, and it happens after birth. And this is the way humans are born. You know, like if you look at a zebra or something, and they come out in the African wild, they're walking right after they're born, and they have to because, you know, they're going to get eaten by a lion. So their brains are fully operational, and they've got, you know, a lot of what they're running on is instinct. So we're quite different. We don't have as much instinct. We have a lot more learned behavior. And so a lot of our myelination happens outside of the womb. And so the completion of the myelination of the nerves, as well as continued growth of the prefrontal cortex, which is, you know, a complex cognitive behavior, personality expression, decision-making, social behavior, and the hippocampus, which is memory. This gets organized by the microbiome. So that part of the microbiome, which is organizing your brain, not only happens before you're born, but continues right afterwards. And then the fourth initiation, and I'm sure there's more, happens in the immune system, then says, okay, I've taught you what self is, not to attack self. Now let me show you what other is, so you know to attack other, right? Hey, you see that little virus that just came in and that bacteria? That's other, go get it. So, you know, and people who have autoimmune diseases, they don't know what self is, they attack themselves. And people that have weak immunity don't know what other is. So to have an effective immune system, you need to help the microbiome. And so all these opportunistic infections, you know, that's, you know, when people say that they've got, I got a call from someone, oh, what do I do today? What do I do about cytomegalovirus or Epstein-Barr? I don't remember which one it was. I'm like, it's an opportunistic infection. Take the opportunity away, you know? So we could get more into the health part. We could talk a little bit about it. And then we'll kind of get into some of the things to repair the microbiome and then, you know, what the microbiome does to our psyche, positive mm-hmm. and negative.
So, well, and maybe too, Spencer, because it is such a big topic, I mean, really, you could have an argument that the gut biome or the microbiome in general could be like the body's most valuable player. I mean, it's a pretty big deal, like you've just outlined. Maybe in somewhere in there, let's talk a little bit about why does it get so out of whack for so many people? What are some of the big players that can disrupt it so that we, and then know why we need to actually kind of fix it and how?
Sure. Okay. So there's three major dangers the microbiome faces. The first is modern diets. We, through, by selective breeding of plants since for the last 10,000 years, we have made plants less bitter and more sweet. Okay. So the bitter compounds, the bitters and the polyphenols and the tannins and these things, these are anti-fermentive. These stop fermentation and are antimicrobial. Sugar is pro-fermentive and pro-microbial. So there's a relationship. You want to have a certain amount of sugar and you want to have a certain amount of antimicrobials so you don't get the bacteria in your small intestine out of whack. And over time, what happens is we've made our food less and less bitter and more sweet. And so now we're basically big fermentation factories and 70% of the people have small intestine bacterial overgrowths and their guts all got out of whack. So the first one is we're not eating food the way it used to be. Now, I make, of the many products I make, one of them is a mix of the oligosaccharides. These are the sugars that we can't digest that the microbiome can, that you would get if you are the world's most successful hunter-gatherer, and boom, there it is. And then the other one is a...
What was that one called?
It's called Panaceum for those guys who are...
Panaceum, okay.
Yeah, listening. And then I make one called Zoibin, which is a liquid, which is a mixture of essential oils and bitters. Because if you were eating a fresh primitive diet, you would be getting essential oils and bitters, both of which are anti-fermentive, antimicrobial, right? But we've bred out the bitters and most of the food we eat, if you don't pick the plant and eat it right then, within 3 hours, the essential oils are gone. So unless you have a windowsill where you're growing oregano, then you're going to get no oregano. You know, you're not going to have oregano oil, essential oil in your food. The same for thyme and all those things. So if we want to kind of get back to a primitive way of living, since we can't, one thing you could do is grow your own herbs, but for the bitters and all these things, you're not going to find them in the grocery store. They've been bred out of existence. So taking bitters externally is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. We just had a meal here. My wife's Persian and, a lot of times we'll meet with, where we live, we kind of live with her parents. So we're both in the same sort of place in two different houses, kind of set up to all live together, in two separate areas. And so we often share meals together. And one thing I really love about some of the Persian meals is that they're really well balanced. So she would made, hodish. So she'll have this sort of stew that's basically a bunch of different vegetables all kind of boiled down and done up with a bit of a stew, usually kind of a bone broth base or something along those lines. And then we'll go to the garden and we will literally right there, pick a bunch of basil and thyme and peppermint or mint leaves, have them in a bowl. And I don't know if you've ever seen like Persian families eat, but you just have this bowl of herbs and you're literally eating your stuff and just eating herbs, fresh herbs right off the plate.
Oh, so you don't mix them? She doesn't mix them in the food. She has them as a side dish.
Yeah. Often you'll have that. Sometimes they are mixed in the food too, but you'll often have just a literally go to the garden. You'll pick them all right there. Go sit down. You have this big bowl of fresh mixed. Usually it's basil and thyme and, and mint. And those are some of the big ones. And you just sit there and as you're eating, you're just eating that.
All right. I'm going to try that. I usually mix it in my food because I have a garden.
The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
But I'm going to try putting in a little side dish. Thank you.
It's really fun. Yeah. And our kids love it too now. And like you said, probably one of the best ways. I mean, you look at a lot of the herbs and the herbs are really packed with a lot of the really important plant chemicals that are really beneficial. Most of them are super high in the herbs. So if you can get those in or like you've compounded them into a specific formulation, I think it's such a great way to get them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's amazing. Okay. So the first one is, we don't get the oligosaccharides we need. We don't have the fuel to feed our microbiome, nor do we have the things to manage the fermentation. The second is chronic exposure to toxins like glyphosates, which specifically wreck the gut. Artificial sugars and pharmaceuticals and oral hormones, they all damage the microbiome. And then the really big killer, of course, is antibiotics. Something like Cipro can wipe out over 50% of your gut microbiome in a few days. And it can also wipe out the microbiome in the appendix, which is the backup. Everybody says the appendix has no value. It's actually a backup copy of your microbiome in case you lose it to dysentery.
Yeah. I remember reading studies on salmonella and they would do animal studies on that. And they would show that I was just reading this the other day as I was working on a book and it was essentially looking at, I think you needed about 500,000 salmonella species to actually create an infection. But after they had, I think it was Cipro, it was one of the stronger antibiotics, and they only needed about six. So it's like because it destroys so much of the beneficial stuff that kind of keeps your resilience up, that you can be so much more susceptible to pathogenic bacteria that can just set in because you don't have the buffer there to deal with it.
Yeah, Cipro is a real mess. I mean, salmonella will wipe out 15% of your gut microbiome, and that's recoverable. Knock out 50%, I mean, that's just really tough. So yeah, the people who have the most difficult time, I find, are those who've had Cipro or those who are premature births are a trick. So how do you know if you have your microbiome's out of whack? Well, okay, there's a stool test you can do for about $500, but let me tell you how to do it kind of at home for $5. Okay, ask yourself a couple of questions. First, does your stool smell bad? It shouldn't smell, right? I mean, maybe like a little sour, a little acidic. That's about it. A healthy microbiome doesn't create bad smells. Dysbiosis creating toxic metabolites like putrescine and cadaverine, these corpse, these are the bacteria that, these are the things that bacteria in corpses create. And that's what gives, you know, stool its bad smell. So first off, it shouldn't have a smell, not much. Secondly, and this is a really easy one, you shouldn't need toilet paper. If your microbiome is good, you should wipe once and then there shouldn't really be anything even on the toilet paper and that's it. And the fact that after, hurricanes and whatever, people run to the stores, they don't get water, they don't get, you know, rice and beans, they don't get Band-Aids and flashlights and batteries. What do they get? They get toilet paper. It tells you just how many people have a wrecked microbiome. Because really, you know, it's like if you were an animal trader and you were buying a horse, the first thing you do is you look at its mouth to see how old it is by how far its gums are receded. And the next thing is you walk around the backside, you lift up its tail and you see if the horse is soiling itself. Because if there's poop all over the horse's backside, that horse's gut is out. Well, it's the same for humans. So, right, you shouldn't need toilet paper. And, you know, one of the fun things is, you know, what I notice is if I take a few days off of the Panacea product, I'm back to where I used to be, which is, oh yeah, I would need toilet paper. And 2 or 3 days back on it and, you know, no need. Okay. So maybe too much information for some people, but there you go.
There's a lot of people that are going to be going, oh shit.
Okay. So, right. All right. So I'm off grid, which means we don't have the greatest amount of electricity. And so I don't have AC. So you're going to see me sweat a little bit. It's in the 90s. Okay. So the next thing is transit time. How long does it take to go from when you eat food to get in the toilet? And it should be about 18 hours. Now, what people are going to say is, I go to the bathroom every day. Therefore, I have a transit time of 1 day. No. What happens is you can go to the bathroom every day, but what goes out of you is what came in a week ago. So how often you go, yes, you should go to the bathroom every day, and it should be what you ate yesterday. So how often you go does not tell you that. What you do is go to the store and buy some chlorophyll and take a tablespoon and then count how many hours it takes for your feces to turn green. Okay. What you're eating is not actually chlorophyll. It's sodium copper chlorophyllin. So you don't want to do a lot of this stuff because Lord knows people don't need any more copper in their bodies. Chlorophyll is actually very hard to get. Chlorophyllin is what's found because it's more stable. In any case, so that tells you the transit time should be 18 hours. pH paper. You want to get some pH paper that goes from 6 to 8, right? And then check. And then you want your stool pH to be around 6.6, 6.8. If it goes above 7 or below 6.2, that's a trouble. And then finally, gas production, right? Everybody's going to have some flatulence. It's natural to produce some hydrogen and carbon dioxide and swallow some gas when you're eating. But I mean, you know, if you have a lot of gas, it's a problem. And if the gas happens to smell, then not only do you have fermentation, which is making the gas, but you've got putrefaction, which is making the smell. Okay. Now, how do you fix the microbiome? So you think probiotics, right? And what you get in the store is Bifidus and Lactobacillus, but that's not what you need. That's what's found in the infant gut. By the time you're 4 years old, you hardly have any Bifidus or Lactobacillus in your system anymore. They're less than 0.1%, I think, of the adult gut microbiome. So why do they keep selling it? Because they're easy to grow, right? Growing the stuff you actually need is very difficult, and they are working on industrial-sized gut simulators to grow bacteria. But then again, it's going to take a while. There's thousands of species. There's a lot of hurdles to go through. So then where would you get bacteria from if you need to get it back in? Well, all right. The first is, just because you might have the bacteria not necessarily be dead, it could just be dormant, right? It might just be sleeping because you haven't fed it in so long. So if you feed it the oligosaccharides, they may come back online. You have a second reserve. So your first reserve for bacteria that's not there is the dormant bacteria that are just hibernating because they're hungry. The second is your appendix, right? As long as you feed it. So again, they're there waiting for the food supply to come back. And the third is other people, which is a fecal transplant, which, you know, some people actually are going to need. Some people have their guts so wiped out that they're going to need to take fecal matter from another human. And we can get into that in another talk and take it rectally and repopulate themselves. And, you know, not something I'd suggest for most people, but if someone is chronically ill, their gut's out of whack, nothing is helping, and they're miserable, yeah, I could talk you through how to do that.
I definitely like, you know, I used to be a big proponent of probiotics way back when. Also, like going through school, there's a lot of talk about, a lot of supplement companies come in and talk about probiotics. And and then I have seen some people do really well with probiotics, but I definitely lean more and more now towards changing the diet and the oligosaccharides to start to support the growth of what might be there as a first step anyways. So I think that's, it just seems like a more natural approach to lighting up what you might already have before you start to try and add something else in that you may not even do well with. A lot of people might take certain probiotics and they actually can make them worse if it's not the right blend for them. At least that way, you're just really feeding what might be there and see how that goes initially.
Yeah, I've got nothing against the idea of probiotics. It's just, we're not technically at the point where they're really available in the kinds we need. You could give someone a probiotic that raises their histamine and they might be histamine intolerant, or you could give them a probiotic that messes around with their GABA function and throws off their GABA glutamate ratios. So I prefer to, if you're going to do a probiotic, I suggest you do them one at a time and not blends, and to see how it works for you.
What are your thoughts, Spencer, on when people are going to be taking an antibiotic? So if they're going to be taking it, and then at least from what I've found over the years of doing it, is I find giving them more something like a Saccharomyces boulardii at the time that they're going to be taking a probiotic or at the time that they're going to be taking an antibiotic seems to be one of the things that I often find sort of supports, because it's not going to get killed off in the process of taking the antibiotic because it's a beneficial yeast, not a bacteria.
Right. It'll displace candida.
Right.
That's one way, one thing you could do. People that take prebiotics with antibiotics find that their microbiome is better able to withstand the insult. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you take a stool sample from yourself in a Ziploc bag with a little bit of water, push all the air out, push it around till it's a gel, and stick it in the fridge before you take the antibiotics. When you're done taking the antibiotics, take your own stool back in. Repopulate. It's your own backup copy.
That'll have to be another discussion on how to do that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about 8 secrets to having a healthy microbiome so you don't necessarily have to go down that route.
Sounds good.
Okay. So the first secret, as we discussed, is the wide range of oligosaccharides. And, you know, you want lots of different ones because, I mean, you never know which one is going to be the one that somebody needs to feed the keystone bacteria that they're having trouble with. Okay. So, now, the second one. So again, humans, you know, we've been here, you know, quasi 200,000 years in the current kind of incarnation, you know, and 190,000 years, we were hunter-gatherers, 10,000 years, we were farmers, and 100,000 years as modern man. And hunter-gatherers eat about 100 grams of fiber a day, early farmers about 35 grams, and modern man about 15 grams. Now, I'm not suggesting you eat like a hunter-gatherer because you'd be chewing tubers all day long. What I would want to recreate is the amount of fiber that the are from the agricultural revolution, you know, that our great grandparents and back for the last 10,000 years were eating. That's 35 grams. And now, how do you get that? Because a cup of shredded carrots is only 3 grams of fiber. So it's actually really the only way to do it's beans. It's the first crop we ever cultivated, and I think probably the best. And a cup of beans will give you 17 grams of fiber, so you're halfway there. Now, a lot of people say, I can't do beans, I get gas. Okay, real easy. Soak the beans for 24 hours and rinse them first, and then slow cook them. And if that's not enough, use adduki beans. Soak those, rinse them, and then slow cook those. And adduki beans that have been slow cooked and rinsed and soaked, rinsed, and slow cooked will produce almost no gas for people. So that's nice. So second secret's beans. The third secret's transit time, right? So food is about 4 hours in the stomach, about 6-7 hours in the small intestine, and then about 10 hours in the large intestine. Now, if your transit time, which you will know from the chlorophyll trick I told you, is less than 16 hours, you don't have enough time to absorb the food. You got the runs, right? But if it's 2, 3, 4, 5 days, then it's sitting around for a while and it's going to make a fermentive mess. So you want to make sure it's moving within 18 hours. And how do you speed it up? Well, one thing is don't sit down. I'm actually standing right now, which is on the top of my head. It's cut off by the camera. When you sit down, you apply pressure to the pelvic region, which is one of the reasons guys have prostate problems and why most people have digestive problems. Sitting down is a terrible posture for the human body. You can squat, you can recline, you can stand. Don't sit. The only time you ever find me sitting is when I'm eating or driving a car. Now, the Hadza, now the other thing is exercise, right? The Hadza of Tanzania, which is probably the most well-documented hunter-gathering tribe we have access to, not that they're modern, but in today, you know, access to right now, they exercise, they walk, you know, about 135 minutes of vigorous exercise a day when they're out hunting or going to get collect tubers. So that means 1.35 minutes of exercise for every gram of fiber. And if you're eating the minimum of 15 grams of fiber, that's a minimum of a 20-minute hike. So just on the normal human modern diet, you want to be at least 20-minute hike or 30-minute walk once a day. And if you're going to get the 35 grams of fiber, you should walk about an hour a day. Right? That's going to get the transit time moving. It's going to move things through. So taking walks is the third secret. And, you know, they used in the old days, you know, after dinner, you had an evening constitutional and ma'am, you'd walk out with your, you know, your partner on your arm and you'd tip your hat to your neighbor and you'd walk around the town square. So yeah, I mean, walking is important. We know that. Another secret, the fourth secret is you don't want to eat dinner too late or breakfast too early. You want to have enough hours where your stomach is empty for the what's called the giant migratory complex or the moving motor complex to move the food to clean up, right? There's this peristaltic action where it moves all the food out of the small intestine, and you need a few hours of empty gut for it to do that properly. So if you want housekeeping done And you do, because if you don't move all the stuff out of the small intestine, that's what's going to create SIBO, is all this junk just sitting there for hours at a time. So, you know, try to have at least 12 hours, 13 hours between dinner and breakfast. Another secret is don't overeat, right? Because you only have a certain digestive capacity. And if you completely overload yourself with protein or sugars or fats at a meal, some of that's going to make its way to the large intestine. And what's going to end up happening is that's going to get turned into, it's going to putrefy into nasty things. Because the large intestine should only have fiber and oligosaccharides in it. You don't want food, you know, digestive food in there. That's a mess for the large intestine. Another secret is digestive enzymes, because that way, you know, because sometimes even people who don't eat too much, they just don't digest well and they end up with undigested food in the large intestine. So digestive enzymes can help that. And then another trick is you make some chilled oatmeal. The oatmeal has beta-glucan, which is a prebiotic. And when you cool off starches for 4 hours, it turns into what's called a retrograde or resistant starch. It's lower glycemic index, and it's also a prebiotic. And then the last thing is, you know, it's a good attitude, right? Because, you know, the microbiome, and this is the part I know you're going to like, the microbiome affects our moods, but our moods affect our microbiome. So the microbiome produces and consumes and regulates the same neurochemicals that we have that create our emotions, right? But our emotions also stimulate the growth of various bacteria. So the emotions of fear and anger and stress, which would be adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol, stimulate the growth of pathological bacteria and increase the virulence of otherwise harmless bacteria. On the other hand, oxytocin, the neurotransmitter associated with the feelings of love and compassion, supports the growth of good bacteria. So, you know, it's up to us. We can have a vicious or virtuous cycle depending on the relationship, you know, our mind has with our microbiome. Now, part of what affects our experience of the world is our neurotransmitters, right? So there's a story of a surgeon who was getting his teeth worked on, and the dentist injected some painkillers, some Novocaine, as a nerve block, so we wouldn't feel the tooth being worked on. Well, when you inject painkillers, you always add a little bit of adrenaline in there because it constricts the blood vessels and keeps the painkiller from getting washed away. Well, what the dentist had done was he inadvertently, when he got the injection to the gum, hit a blood vessel and injected the painkiller and the adrenaline directly into the bloodstream of the doctor. Now, the doctor knew immediately what happened. He's like, oh, I'm just got dosed with adrenaline. It did not stop him from running, screaming like a maniac out of the office, you know, away from the saber-toothed tiger that his body was sure was around the corner. So there this guy is having a complete panic attack and terror, in complete terror, while he knows there's nothing to be afraid of. He can't stop it, right? He didn't have the, and who, maybe no one would. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no matter how strong your cultivation is, enough of a neurotransmitter in your system and you're going to have an experience.
Yeah.
Right. Now, here's something that's interesting. The neurotransmitters we use, serotonin, dopamine, adrenaline, do you know where they were first found in nature?
Where?
Bacteria. They are how bacteria coordinate, communicate, and regulate themselves. So when I say that the gut was the first brain and ours is the second brain, mm-hmm. I mean that not only in terms of time, but the very language that our brain is using was taught to us by our microbiome. We use the chemistry that the microbiome invented and we co-opted it and worked with it. So this is a very ancient relationship, a very ancient symbiotic relationship. Well, hopefully it's symbiotic, right? Because modern diets and antibiotics have definitely made it difficult for the microbiome to behave in a way that it would like to. It's put in a position where being symbiotic isn't really working for it.
The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I think that's fascinating. I didn't think about that in that regard, from bacteria being the first ones for the neurochemistry like that. I mean, it really is fascinating. The more you kind of go into this and the more you learn about it, it really is, ultimately, it is this symbiotic experience. I think if we think about it like that too, and we, then it's going to change the choices that we're going to make as far as how do we support this thing that's ultimately providing so much more benefit for our overall well-being.
Right. You know, I mean, obviously we want to cultivate so we get to the point where if we have cortisol, we're not yelling at people, right? If we have serotonin and dopamine problems, we're not getting really depressed. But we also want to take responsibility for not putting ourselves in a neurochemical position where it's really, really hard to do that.
Yeah.
Where we're suffering and just trying to hold our center. So,
Well, and it's so much more work. It also creates like a ton of pressure and guilt and all these types of things. It's like if someone's got huge dysglycemia and their blood sugar is spiraling up and down, it's like it's very hard to get control of your mood and behavior when you're on such swings. Mm-hmm. Or from the Walsh approach stuff we'll see for mental health. So if people have like a, you know, pyrolurea, or if they have really high copper, low zinc, and they're, you know, shunting all this dopamine over to norepinephrine, it's like, you know, it literally feels really intense in the body. So it takes so much work to try to be able to, like, you know, be mindful and meditate or get a hold of your emotions and self-control when everything inside you from a biochemical standpoint is just driving you in a certain direction. So to me, like, a lot of times people aren't even aware that those things are precursors to why they're feeling and behaving in a certain way. And so I guess that kind of ties in why I wanted to have this conversation around gut biome, because gut biome is a major player for that. And a lot of times people don't realize that their behavior is coming because something might be out of balance in there. And when that starts to get adjusted, all of a sudden the intensity of the emotion or the intensity of the desire or the drive towards something or the addiction towards something often just comes down, where then it becomes much more manageable to then make some of the changes that we need to make changes in. But sometimes it's almost impossible, I think, sometimes when there's such strong physiological things in the way of it.
So one of the things I started realizing as I was working with the microbiome is that it would not classically present as a gut disorder. I mean, yeah, the people's guts would be out, but the main thing that you would find would be neurological and fatigue. So people's moods would just be wrecked when their gut was out of whack, and in different ways, right? Because there's thousands of different bacteria and stuff like that. So one of the nice things I was noticing is when people's microbiome improved, they just became happier and more well-adjusted people. I'll give you another example of how moods can be affected. Bacteria have been around humans, gosh, now, quite some time, right? And hang on. Let me just pull up some notes on bacteria. Okay, so we've had bacterias for around, all right, so the mammal's immune system is around 200 million years old. And parasites have been infecting us and our mammalian ancestors for about 500 million years, 500 million years. And they've learned all these neat tricks, right? And one of the tricks they do is they can vary their surface proteins. So as an example, T. brucei, which is the parasite that causes sleeping sickness, has over 2,000 genes that code for the protein on the surface. So their parasites are really the masters of disguise. So what happens is the immune system figures out, oh, there's the parasite, and then it goes after it at metabolic expense. It takes energy. And then parasite changes its coat, you know, takes off the blue hat and black coat and puts on a white hat and a green cardigan. And now the immune system says, wait, aren't you a parasite? And goes, no, right? And when I mean parasites, I don't necessarily mean worms, viruses. It's anything that takes without giving. So viruses can be parasitic and that kind of thing, right? So basically what they do is they're invisible, right? Invisibility is a tactical game changer, you know? When you can't see your opponent, boy, they can just, you know, how do you fight them, right? How do you fight an invisible opponent? One of the things you need to do to be able to fight these things, like cancer, is another example. Cancer manipulates the immune system into a very narrow window of T regulatory cell expression and some other elements, so that there's this very narrow window in which the immune system can't see cancer. And cancer manipulates the immune system into this very narrow window where it's invisible. Same for like Lyme disease, right? Like that's another thing that is really good at hiding and cloaking. So how do we deal with a cloaked adversary? Okay, well, the parasites have been around for 500 million years, but our microbiome has been around for what, 3 billion years. So, you know, it's nothing new under the sun. There's no tricks that the microbiome hasn't seen. And the microbiome, it's one of its jobs is to decloak infections, is to decloak cancer, to decloak parasites and viruses so that the immune system can go after it. I mean, as an example, think of it this way, right? You can go and outfit your army with more and more guns, or you can give them night vision. If they've already got guns, another gun is not going to do anything. Night vision is a game changer in the military world, right? To be able to see in the dark so your opponent can't be invisible, right? So that's the immune system. Giving it one more gun, giving it one more thing to stimulate it, you may be useful, but if it can't see its opponent, it's not going to do much. Now, so you want to use the microbiome to unmask parasites. Now, how does this play into moods? So there is a parasite that infects mice and cats, or rats and cats, right? You're familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah, probably toxoplasmosis.
Toxoplasmosis, right. Toxoplasma gondii. And what it does is it gets into the mouse and makes the mouse like the smell of cat pee. So normally it should be running away from cat urine because the cat's its natural predator. In this case, it goes, ah, mi amor, I love the smell of cat pee. And then the cat eats it. And why does it eat it? Because the parasite needs to be in the cat gut to get to the next cycle of its replication. And so now the Toxoplasma gondii is manipulating the brain of the mouse to get it into the gut of the cat. And this is just one of many parasites that manipulate host attraction and aversion, right? It happens all the time in the insect world. And there's an enormous number of people that actually have Toxoplasma gondii in the human race. And my guess is that the cyclings of wars is actually related to cyclings of blooms and of the Toxoplasma gondii in the human population. In human beings, you find Toxoplasma gondii at higher levels in people that do really risky things or suicide or murder. So it makes them very dangerous to themselves and others. So I think that might be one of the driving forces actually for wars of many, is that there's a natural bloom every whatever number of years and everybody gets infected and just goes a little mad. So in terms of free will, okay, how does that play out? Well, you know, parasites and cancer, they're simple creatures and they live on sugar and glutamate, right? And they're killed by bitters. Well, glutamate is the savory flavor. So what are your two favorite flavors, Jason?
Oh, you probably, for the vast majority of people, it would be sugar and salt.
Okay. And for a lot of people, it would be savory.
Right? Savory, yeah.
Right. That really savory, meaty flavor.
Right.
Right. And then there's a really sweet flavor. So like the bacon flavor, that's savory.
Right,
savory.
Right.
Okay, yeah. And what's the flavor people like the least? Bitter.
Bitter.
Well, why is it? If the bitter is the most medicinal thing, and if eating more sugar than you can metabolize leads to all sorts of diseases, why do we keep craving it so much? Why do we keep perhaps we're craving the glutamate and the sugar because that's directly what feeds the parasites. So
yeah. I think that happens so much more than people are ever aware of. And you know, when we had our kids, we got our kids right from day one trying. And I think this for new parents out there with your kids, it's really important too to develop your child's palate, I think, early on. So I mean, we would give them bitters and sours, and we would have them like the whole array, so they got used to everything. And really, don't overtrain the particularly I think the sweet and the salty, because it really, everything in North American diet is so overabundant in that it's gonna move things in a wrong direction. But if you train them early on, or if you you know, have some of these other sort of cultural diets that I think are more balanced and incorporate some of the different herbs and stuff in them, because you get those flavors in those foods early on. Mm. Your kids will develop a flavor for it, and then it's not so foreign to them. There's not this, ooh, gross. It's, you know, our kids are in there digging out and eating the herbs. They'll go in the garden and pull out fresh herbs and eat them. Any tinctures, and you know how kind of nasty some of the different tinctures can taste when you're getting into like liver tinctures and some of the immune tinctures. My kids will take them all. They're just so used to them from early on. So, you know, and then you're going to find you're going to have a lot less picky eaters down the road too. They get picky when they get really trained over and over to really only appreciate two tastes. And then I think exactly what you're talking about, you set the stage for some of these bugs to take over, and then it becomes really hard for them to start to have some of these different things, because, you know, there's a life and death battle that goes with it inside their body.
Mm, yeah, I was teaching my kids to eat liver and chlorella as candy.
Or yeah.
I was like, oh, would you like some candy? Yeah. And I give them spirulina. They're like, oh, this is candy? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, and they get like whatever they get used to, right? Yeah, exactly. So liver might be a hard stretch to make it candy, but if they don't know what candy is, then
right. Well, I'm a guy. I mean, they would, you know, every other day I'd go to the liver pill bottle and it would be empty. I'm like, all right, who ate all the liver?
Good. Yeah. I think like you just got to start early with kids around that, but it really is fascinating because you think like if that is going on and we do start to get an imbalance in that microflora and we start to all of a sudden get parasites or different bugs that we don't necessarily want there, it absolutely can start to influence. I mean, even simply like, you know, people see like candida. Lots of people have candida. Candida, what does that want to eat? You know, you get lots of cravings for simple sugars, you know, things that are like really refined carbohydrates very quickly, because that's what, or alcohol, right? It's wanting to kind of just keep feeding itself. Mm. Spencer, to kind of finish up, what would be kind of maybe for people that are really sort of starting off on this and not too sure where to begin, where would be some good first steps for someone to get back in control of their microbiome so that they can start that process of mastering their own life again?
Right. So go back to those tests I talked about. First, determine what kind of state your microbiome is in. If you have money, you know, go get a stool test and then you'll have a really good sense of it. And then you have a metric. If the test comes out fine, then you're great. If not, then you need to start making adjustments. You might need to be on a FODMAP diet for a little while. You might definitely want to be taking some oligosaccharides. You might need some bitters incorporated. And if you can afford it, and you could also get the Food Marble Air 2 device, which will measure breath, hydrogen, and methane and kind of help you figure out what foods are creating gases in your gut. And slowly work your way towards finding a diet that really supports your body and your psyche.
Mm-hmm. Is there any specific diet that you tend to start with for people that you think is a good starting place? Or do you really find very individual for everybody? Is there a certain starting place that you like to see where people are, just as far as a first step for diet?
So I'm of the omnivore camp. I think that people who are carnivores, you know, I respect that they found a way to feel healthy, right? They definitely upgraded themselves from a pathological microbiome to a healthy but limited microbiome. But I think long-term, if they end up becoming sensitive to meat after 20 years, they'll be left unable to eat anything. So I'm of the omnivore camp. So, you know, what I would do is start with, low oxalate, low histamine foods, low glutamate foods. Those are all pretty, you know, some things that are pretty neutral for everybody. So I'm a fan of soaked, slow-cooked adduki beans and, naturally pastured meats. And I think, you know, if you really want to be healthy, you have to have a garden, because there's really no way to get the vegetables you eat in the store. I mean, they were picked days ago. You know, they're already wilting and rotting. So, but you know, if you can't grow your own food, you know, go to a farmer's market and get fresh food. You'll find, you know, that if you didn't like eating vegetables, you might find that you actually do like them when they're fresh.
this comes to the end of our time for this episode. Please go to inspirehealthpodcast.com and listen to the remainder of this important episode. Thank you so much.